introduce them, and they're going to talk about their program and what they're going to do, and they're going to put you guys through your paces a little bit. Dalton is a fourth-generation rancher from West Central Texas. He graduated from Texas A&M with a bachelor's and a master's degree in ag economics. His wife, Gretchen, and their three daughters operate Maddox Ranch and live south of Colorado City, Texas. Their operation consists of running cows and calves on ranches at Roscoe, Colorado City, and Ozona, Texas, as well as manage the hunters on these ranches. They raise goats and sheep and graze stockers on an irrigated farm at Colorado City and have a preconditioning yard on the farm as well. Dalton and his family are just starting a hunting development company to sell ranches to hunting groups and then developing them for the new owners who are mainly interested in their recreational values. He also sells real estate and is currently managing a quail hunting ranch for North Carolina landowners. His three greatest teachers have been Bud Williams, Alan Savory, and Alan Nation. Dr. Boyles was raised on a research farm in southeast Ohio. He received his BS degree from Virginia Tech in animal science and MS from Ohio State the National Champion Ohio State University. I'm a Nebraska fan. That's hard. That's really hard. In reproductive physiology and a PhD in ruminant nutrition from Kansas State University. Upon graduation, Dr. Boyles served on the faculty of North Dakota State University as a livestock extension specialist. His main focus was beef cattle, but was also the extension equine nutritionist and served as the dairy specialist for 1 year. Currently, Dr. Boyles is the OSU extension beef specialist. His current area of focus is in extension programming is beef quality assurance. His research program involves forage use and also ultrasound as a tool to evaluate body composition. Dr. Boyles has served as a beef cattle consultant in Mexico, Chile, Argentina, Brazil, Slovakia, Russia, and Mongolia. Please help me welcome Dalton and Dr. Boyles.
There's little dots there next to the corral, and or you can just tear off strips of paper and put it in proximity to where you think those design flaws are. On the center table in the back are several different versions of crowding areas, crowding tubs. And you need to at least lay down one dot or piece of paper which you think is the best one for your operation. Up here also, here's some working alleys. Different configurations, which one do you think is the best? Even if there's maybe a first, second, and third, we'll just work on the best. And then on this corner table, there's two situations. One is an unloading chute, which is the best design for unloading. And then in the corner there on the same table is an area where there's a crowding area going into an alley that has a roof and or shade area, which design is best there. So for the next 10 to 15 minutes, you're not going to fall asleep. You need to get up, go to one of these sites, and judge these facilities. For these corral kits, this is actually one of the NCBA Beef Quality Assurance pilot projects that was started this past year. Hopefully you're enjoying using them and having good discussion about corral design, and I think that was the purpose of this as we continue to use it today. But I would like personally to express my appreciation to you. I hopefully feel that some of your pilot project funds are being well used. I know there's another pilot project representative down here at Purdue University, and if you want to talk to the gentleman about their BQA website, there's another interesting and useful project. So with that, I'm going to turn this program over to you.
Thanks, Steve. I'll try to use one of these. Is that better? I want to thank Renee and NCBA for asking me to come talk today. And it's nice to come down where it's warm, where it's raining. West Texas has been pretty dry for the last 5 or 6 years. I think the last time I fixed water gaps was in 1997. But, we've had a little bit of rain this past fall and spring, and hopefully we can get some wheat going and things will start looking up. I met Steve this morning. We came in to make sure we knew where the room was and everything, and we talked for 10 or 15 minutes, and we both agreed that we were experts, but everybody does know the definition of an expert, and that's somebody from out of town, and I'm from Texas, and he's from Ohio, so I figured we qualified in that regard anyway. How many people have ever heard of a man, Bud Williams, or been to a school? That's good. I had a real unique opportunity. It was in, I believe, 1990, 89 or 90. We met him at a field day, and through the course of several conversations and things working out the way they did, he spent a year at our ranch in Texas, and I learned probably more from anybody. I learned more from him than anybody that I'd ever been around. I mean, it was kind of a hands-on startup to trying to learn how to handle cattle a lot better than we do. In the mid-80s, we went to some holistic resource management courses, and we were implementing some electric fencing and trying to amalgamate our herds to control the grazing better. And we were trying to take our old ways and put it into a new system, and it wasn't working real well. We were doging calves. Every time we moved cattle to a new pasture, they walked the fences, they were bawling, the water wasn't set up right. Lots of things weren't going right, and we knew we needed somehow or another to find a way to treat the animals a little better so they would respond better to us. And fortunately for us, we had him there for a year working with us. He started training us first, and then after the long period of doing that, the short period was training the livestock, and that was a real good experience for us because we really needed some way to get those cattle to respond to the new management we were trying to implement at that time. In the past, we basically trapped our cattle. We gathered them two or three times a year. They were, we had 20,000 acres there, and we had cattle and sheep in each pasture, and we gathered them whenever we needed to work them. So we treated them however we could to get them in the pen, and there was gates that, I remember as a kid growing up, we couldn't beat the sheep through that gate hard enough to get them to go in there, because every time they went in there, something bad happened to them. We never did correlate those two things to how we handled them trying to go in and the amount of time that we handled them as to how they handled after they got in and what we did to them. They finally got used to every time we moved them to a fresh pasture, whether we were on foot or horseback or whatever, that correlated to fresh pasture. And so their mindset started to change a little better, and we handled them a lot differently by getting their flow going and moving them to the next pasture. But it was, like I said, it was a really eye-opening experience to see, if we act a little different around the cattle, and the cattle respond real well to that. To start off with, I want to point out that he tried to train, had to train us a lot longer than it took us to train the cattle. Our mindset is real important as to how we handle those cattle when we go out. If we're, if we've got a colt that needs to be ridden, and we've just talked to the bank, we've got two notes that are overdue, and we've got 15 minutes to get out there and do something with him because we've got two loads of cattle coming in right after lunch, we hop on that colt, and things don't seem to go very well. A lot of that's due to, maybe not necessarily the stress that we're under, but the mindset that we've got and the attitude that we've got when we go out there to work those animals. If we're in a good mood or, things are going well, we tend to have things work a lot better for us. So we got to start with ourselves and try and understand that, you know, what we do, you know, the animals are going to be truthful in what they do. There are certain areas that we can put ourselves in, and they're going to respond accordingly. And if our mindset is to go out there and work those cattle in a certain way, the way we handle ourselves is how those the cattle will respond to that. So we've got to start with ourselves to make sure that we understand what we're trying to do. And unfortunately for us, women are a lot better at that than we are. They're more calmer in nature than most of us are, and they tend to move things a lot slower and a lot more calmly, and tend to work a lot better. I mean, my wife's twice as good as I am at it, and she really didn't have to learn anything from it. But they do tend to work cattle a lot less stressful than most of us do. When we talk about what we're going to do with these cattle, with these corral designs, and what we're going to do with them when we get them in there, or when we're putting them in the corrals, we've got to talk about movement. You know, there's flight zones or comfort zones around cattle, and I've set up a nice cow here on the stage. I was afraid I couldn't put something that large on the plane with me, and I didn't feel real comfortable with one of those 6-inch cows up here, so I thought I'd put something up here. And there are certain areas around an animal that they'll let you get so close before they'll move, and you cross through that comfort zone or flight zone or whatever you want to call it as you approach that animal. And it's the same way with a 500 head of cows or 4 head of cows. There's a certain area in there that they feel comfortable with you being out here doing whatever you're doing, and once you move into that, they're going to respond accordingly, whether they're going to move away, whether they're going to come towards you. So we've got to talk about what cattle like and what they don't like as far as what their comfort zones are. And if I could get somebody to just, all I need somebody to do is just walk down this hallway. Anybody. Somebody just, all I need you to do is just start walking down the hallway. It's right there. That's good. Cattle don't like for somebody to be right behind them. All they want to do is they want to turn both ways. They're trying to see where you're at, and also, thank you, that's good. Sorry about that. They want to see where you are, and they also want to see where you want them to go. So if this animal is here and I want them to go, what do we normally tend to do? We're going to a pen, we go over here, and we go get behind them. Then if everything gets crowded up at the gate, we can't figure out why they're not going in. So we build corrals to try to, most of the stuff that we've got was built to try to force them to go in there. But it's a lot easier if this animal is facing me or whichever direction he's facing. If I want him to go by me, I just walk by and let him pass because he can see where he wants to go, and I've released that pressure from him. I'm not standing here behind him trying to get him to figure out where he wants me to go. But those animals, when they do that, you know, Bud talks a lot about applying pressure and releasing pressure, but it makes a big difference if that animal knows he's got a way to go and that somebody's not actually standing there beside him. But, you know, a lot of that stuff deals with the flight zones, and I'm just trying to touch on a lot of this stuff because I've got some slides that I'll show of us doing some stuff. It's hard to tell, but I'm hoping it'll spark some questions that people have or something that somebody else has done that's stuck with Bud or had him at the ranch or had a course to try and see how we can handle these cattle a lot better. But the main thing is to apply that pressure and let those animals go. If you're driving down the highway and somebody speeds up behind you and then they just stay right behind you, you're always looking in the mirror, you're looking to the left, and after a while the fear turns into anger because you're wondering why that SOB is sitting there behind me and he's ran up behind me all this way. Now he's following me. But if he speeds up behind you, goes around you and goes on, you never think about it again. But what it does, for some reason or another, it raises a stress level in us, just like it would the animals with somebody being behind them. And our tendency is to go get behind the cattle instead of being in front. It's just like when you're counting animals out the gate, they're coming by you as fast as they can, and somebody's in front of them, and nobody's pushing them from behind. They like to go past you. That releases that pressure from them. So it's really important that we understand that if we're going to apply some pressure to those animals, we'll also have them a place to remove that pressure. The large herd movement, we were moving anywhere from, at one time we had one group of, I think, between 2 and 2,500 head of yearlings, and we had a group of about 750 pair. You know, we didn't know anybody that had ever tried to handle that large of a group of cattle on a day-to-day basis, moving them 2 to 3 to 4 days a week. And, when Bud was there, you know, it all talked about how we can get the movement started. We have to have some type of movement, and then where we position ourselves is how well those cattle are going to handle. And it works the same. You apply the pressure when you approach the animal. You apply some what he calls zigzag pressure, where you're not directly at that animal. And if you are, then you just basically pull back and remove that pressure. And that zigzag motion lets him know where you're going to be, and also it allows him a place where he can move and release that pressure. But it's, you know, and a lot of times we'd be out there doing stuff, and you're like, well, I'm not doing anything out here. I'm just, you know, going back and forth, and cattle are moving along, and what am I doing? Well, they're doing what you're wanting them to do. It's just not taking as much energy as you used to. Because we used to, like I said, we had places that we couldn't get, you know, we just basically physically beat the animals into the alley because we couldn't get them in there any other way. But we did a lot of hollering and screaming and yelling and a lot of other things. And we were a lot tighter than the animals were when we got finished. But once we understand that movement and how to use it to our benefit, to benefit the animals, he helped us a lot with when we received stalkers or weaned calves. And we'd get the stalkers in. It would, you know, it'd be late at night or whenever the trucks came in, and we would go out there, and basically they're running and bawling and whatever, you know, they've been stressed pretty well by the time they get there. And we'd try to slow that movement down by where we were placing ourselves. And once we did that, we were stopping the dust that was really boiling up in the pens. And at the same time, we were calming those animals down. But, if you know, a lot of times they come in at 2 o'clock in the morning, that's how we'll feed them in the morning. We'll go down there and do them. It makes a big difference that first 4 hours that they're out there and nobody's tending to them. And so we, you know, any time a truck came in, whatever time of day or night, somebody would go out there and try to slow that movement down just to try to calm those animals down. And once you've done that, then you can move yourself and pressure those animals to feed and water. And, you know, it doesn't just depends on how stressed the animals are when they come in. It's, you know, it might take 15 minutes, it might take 45 minutes. But all you're trying to do is slow those animals down, taking the stress off of them, and then give them something good to eat and drink. And, you know, a good fill is worth a lot more than 2 or 3 shots of Atril or Mocktail or whatever. And then you're basically down to whatever vaccines you're going to get. But just that slowing and somebody's presence out there, you know, was a lot more than we were doing before. You know, we didn't think we were doing a whole lot. But as time went on, we could see how those animals were responding. So we'd slow that movement down and get them to eating and drinking. And then those cattle, you know, gradually start to lay down and stuff because they're tired. Some of them have been on the truck for 24 hours. And it really made a big difference on how we just took a little, whatever little bit of stress we were taking off of them. And then we'd let those cattle, usually, depending on how long they'd been on a truck, we'd usually let them rest for 24 hours. And then we'd go through branding, vaccination, whatever we were going to do to the cattle. And like I said, the pasture handling on those cattle, you've got the movement that you're trying to, you know, whether it's, you know, like I said, some of our herds were up to 600 and 700 cows. But once that movement was started, our tendency is on a big herd like that is to have everybody behind. And we got, you know, we'd have 5 cowboys at the back and 5 cowboys up the side trying to build a corral as we went in. But, you know, we can do most of that stuff now with 1 or 2 people because, you know, the animals have been handled different is one thing, but we're also in a position where we can let the cattle go in a certain direction, and we're also applying the pressure that keeps them from stopping. It also keeps them from turning out. But a lot of it is, you know, taking that zigzag motion, applying the pressure where you need it, and getting that movement going, and it'll pull most of the animals to it. Because in the past, we'd have a large, you know, 3,000 or 4,000 acre pasture trying to gather cows. Well, everybody lines up and fans out to go around it. Well, the guy on the outside always was ahead because he was kind of leading the troops. But a lot of times, if the gate was on the other end, the movement needed to be ahead of him so that all the cattle we were bringing in were coming from behind. We'd always throw the cattle out in front, but all we were doing was stopping the movement. So if we had the herd moving forward, and then the guys on the outside would shift to the back and throw the cattle in because that movement would actually draw. You know, any time cattle in a pen start to move, eventually all of them start to move because that movement is pulling those other animals in there. And like I said, the similarities between the smaller groups in the pen or the larger cattle out in the pasture, it's pretty much the same. That movement kind of dictates what is going to happen to that group once you get them in the pen. If it's, you know, if everything's going well, most times when you get the cattle in the pen, everything works well, as you know, in the same way. But if you have a lot of trouble getting that movement and, you know, cattle are spoiled or whatever and they're trying to turn back, you have that same trouble, you know, once you get them in the pen. But another thing that I realized once we started doing that was we were doging calves the old way, and now, you know, sometimes you feed cows, some of them bring the calves and some of them don't. It's just the comfort level that some of those cows have, and the more comfortable they feel around you, the more and more those cows bring their calves. And we'd go move a pasture by using the zigzag motion and that movement starting. Those cows would pick those calves up, and we weren't having, you know, a wad of 150 calves at the back, you know, running back, and we're trying to whip those up to the front, and all the cows at the front are running off. We're keeping a lot of those pairs together, and it makes a big difference, because all you got to do when they go to a gate, you know, some of our stuff, you know, we really didn't redesign anything. We just kind of used our old primitive gates and corrals. And, you know, when you have 750 cows and a 12-foot gate, you're going to peel some calves off at the back, you know, however you do it. But that's a lot of the stuff we picked up as we went along. We realized that if we had a 30-foot gate there, we wouldn't drop those calves back because they're already with the cow. And as soon as they went through a gate, they'd drop their head down and start to graze. You know, those cattle aren't stressed, but if you honked them in there or whatever, and they started running the pasture, you know, they're losing weight, they're starting to get stressed, and that's what we were doing before. We said, oh, well, we stressed them so bad, let's let them out of the pen let them settle down. Well, all they did was just take off. Nobody was ahead of them. So anything we take out now, we go out there and slow the movement down, let them just start to graze, and most of that stress has been relieved from them. But, I can't say enough, a lot of the things that you think that you're supposed to be out there doing, you don't feel like you're really doing a whole lot, but it's doing a whole lot to those cattle. Just your presence there, taking that stress off of those cattle, makes a big difference. And I don't know if anybody uses dogs. We use border collies, and animals tend to work real well for other animals. I mean, a border collie's natural instinct is to go around and bring something to you, but their movement is like this. It's not just go and get behind and run right up into the herd. They'll apply the pressure, and then you can down them or whatever, and they're basically working back and forth to bring those animals to you, and just train them. You know, we would train ours to where the border collies like to bring rather than drive. But if you're going along a fence, we'd train them to where they would just apply the pressure where we wanted it, and we could just move up the side, and those dogs would be back there bringing the cattle along, and they adapted to it real well because it's hard to, you know, stand right in front of them like you can a herd of sheep where they'll bunch up, but the cattle, you know, they work real well for that. That's really about all I wanted to touch on as far as, you know, we don't have enough time to really go into a whole lot of detail, but I hope we can, you know, some of the other guys that have seen Bud stuff, I'd like to talk to you or talk to me or whatever and see, you know, some stuff that I could, you know, learn from you guys. And I've got a few slides that I'll just go over quickly to try to illustrate. It's hard to illustrate movement with still slides, but I'll try to, you know, talk about what we're actually doing. So if somebody could turn the machine on and the lights down, we'll go through these real quick. And then Steve's got to talk about what he's got developed with his corral designs. We talked first a little bit about, can they turn the lights down just a little? I don't know if that'll help the guys in the back see any better. I set this up to where I could either talk with them or without them, so I basically had that one in there to see what kind of attitude we had when we went out to the pasture, but I don't know what kind of attitude he's got, but he'd probably do about whatever he wanted to. How many of us have these at home? They're not real, they don't go real good with low stress handling. That was one of the first things that Bud got rid of for us was, we were in Mexico one time, working with some guys down there that were having an 8 and 10% death loss. And he gathered up all our whips and, you know, we've had Spanish guys work for us forever and still do. And, of course, Bud said, well, let's just unload the truck and see how you do it. Well, there was, you know, a Mexican with a stick about every 8 feet down the truck, you know, trying to get the cattle off. And first thing he did is gather up all their sticks and whips. And the last thing he said when we left, he said, if you don't do anything that we've talked about while I was here, if you'll put your hands in your pockets and quit yelling, he said, that'll be the best thing we can do for you. We had to wean some calves the other day, and I just stuck the camera on my horse when we took out. There's 400 cows and calves. We'd weaned a set of early calves. We put all of our cows together and there's a long story behind why we've got two cabbage berries. But anyway, we wean twice a year now, and we were weeding. We'd already weaned the first bunch, and they were just starting to calve, and so we were picking the second bunch off of these cows. And I just put my camera on my saddle just to show we're just trying to get a little bit of movement. I've got a good set of hired hands. They're all professionals. I've got a picture of them there at the last. But we're just trying to get some movement started here. And like I said, there's about 400 cows and a little over 200 calves here. Well, that slide's not real good. This is the same bunch of cows, just wanting to show, you know, where the movement's going. This is, we got to this pasture, it's about 3,500 acres. And there's the same picture of the same, you know, they're, you know, we've got a pretty good wide, you know, herd there, but everything's, all the heads are facing the same direction. That's just, I've got up on the hill there above the cattle, and that's about a third of them there at the back. Trying to show we've got some movement. This is another slide on a, that I had taken 3 or 4 years ago. The same group of cows on a different ranch. You can see all the movement is, you know, we've got the head of the movement. I don't have a pointer, but up to the left of the screen is the head of the movement, and there at the back is where everything's drawing to that movement. I put this in to show that you don't have to be horseback. You can be on foot. Bud's done some stuff in Australia now with herding, you know, gathering cattle with helicopters, doing the same thing he's doing. I was just on a four-wheeler that day. There's about 750 yearlings in that picture. But the same movement applies to whatever you're on. I mean, you can't ride a motorcycle right through the middle of the herd. But once animals get used to it, it's the same principle of moving back and forth. That's the same group of yearlings there. So you can, you know, you can handle, you know, as large a herd as you feel comfortable. We just felt like we weren't getting, with our bigger pastures, even though we had 60 pastures, we weren't getting the densities that we wanted. And so we just amalgamated all of our herds and started putting all those cattle together. But that's why it was real important that Bud was helping us, so that, you know, he was saying, when, you know, they used to drive cattle to Kansas, but the cattle gained weight the whole way. You know, the way we handled them before, they lost weight the whole way. That's just an area of some broom snakeweed. We took those bulls and fed some cubes on them. I just threw that in there to show that you can, you know, do a lot of different stuff with the animals. These are some of the calves that we had just weaned out of that first picture where we were horseback. I just had my wife take a couple of pictures. All I'm trying to show there is we've got some movement coming. The feed bunks are back, would be back up ahead of these cattle where they're at. Just showing some movement from the side. You're just applying some pressure there. And that's those cattle about 2.5 hours later. We weaned them. That was about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. We weaned them about 9:30 that morning. You know, they're not going to just walk in the pen and you work with them 30 minutes and lay down. But if you just continue to try to do that, get them full and work that movement back and forth. I call it working with the cattle. I don't know if there's a better term for it. But all you're trying to do is slow that movement down and get those cattle to eat and drink. And it makes a lot of difference on your vet costs. That's just a picture of some electric fencing that we put in, and that's when we started, you know, putting all of our herds together. This is a picture. This, in the background, you can see there's a that's 2 10-foot gates there that are open, and there's about 750 pair in that. Focus on that. That's back when it was raining. I think that picture was taken in '97. But the cows, you know, the gates 15 feet behind them, and they're already dropped their heads and eaten. So it makes a big difference, as, you know, whereas before we pull them in, open the gates, and start moving the cattle in, and they would take off. That's just the same gate there. This is just to show some of the effects. This is there's a water trough right there beside where I'm taking all of our dirt tanks in the past. You know, were dirt for 100 yards away from, but the cattle were in the pasture all the time, just pounding away at the water points. And, you know, we got to, when it got to dry, we went to 240 days on the recovery cycle. And, you know, basically I had 100 years of rainfall data, and I was trying to pick if it, you know, whatever heavy rainfall months of 3 inches or more, how long was the biggest span, and it didn't do that. Well, 4 times it was 240 days, so we went to 240 days. And we were still getting that kind of growth on, you know, less than half of our rainfall, but we weren't even grazing our pastures on average more than 1.5 to 2 times a year. That's just the same picture there, just to show you that the grass will grow all the way up to the water if it's got time to come back. This is a picture of me sorting those calves off. Most of the stuff that we've got is pretty primitive. We operate a lot of lease country, and you know, you can't afford to go in and build a nice set of corrals like we're going to talk about here. But this is about a 10-foot alley, and we've got the cows are in the pen on either side of this alley. We'd put them in there and let the, you know, I like doing, you know, sorting the cows off of the calves in a larger pen. We just don't have a big enough pen to do it on this place. So we've got this alley, and we've got, you know, baby calves all the way up to 400-pound calves. And so all I was trying to show is if you move in to let those cattle by and then back out, you know, we're sorting the cows and calves, and I got my wife running the gate behind me. And we were through, you know, by noon, gathering that pasture. And there's just, you know, most times you put baby calves in with a crowded set of cows like that, most of them don't come out in too good a shape. But those cows, they've handled pretty good, so we don't. It's not much of a big deal to put them in there with them. That's just a slide of where we precondition our calves there at that irrigated farm. And we'll bring the calves in there and straighten them out and put them on wheat or sell them and contract them back or something. There's my professional crew. My wife, all the kids are less than, I guess the oldest two are my daughter and my hand son. They're 12, but there's four kids and then the one Spanish guy that works for me and us. We got 700 cows and 1,000 yearlings, and we can kind of, you know, so we'll hire extra help sometimes if we're running a calf trailer or something. But most of the moving and stuff, you know, the cattle's handled real well, and so it doesn't take much to, you know, we gathered those 350 cows and weaned the calves off, and we were through by, you know, hauling the calves by 1 o'clock. So we got along pretty good with them. I think that's it. I think Steve wants to... Yeah, I mean, we can do questions now or however anybody wants. I think we've got plenty of time to do either one. If you want to set up some corrals, you know, if somebody's got something that works real good or something that doesn't work real good. I mean, like I said, the only reason I'm an expert is I'm from out of town. So. There's several guys down there. The last ones I got were from Bob Buchholz. He's down at El Dorado. But there's, you know, a lot of those guys in that, if you get the Livestock Weekly, there's several ads. I mean, there's lots of guys in Texas that are raising them. I don't know how good they are. Bud always took whatever somebody didn't want, but he was a lot better at trading them than I am. But I really like the, you know, you'll get some border collies that are a lot better sheepdog than they are cowdog, and that's just because they're less aggressive, and the collies that are more aggressive are better for cows, and you really don't want to do both, but they, you know, they work really well, especially if you're, you know, like we gather a lot of sheep and goats, and they're working a mint for that. You know, cattle that handle real good, it's not that necessary, but they sure work good for other, you know, they work good for the dogs, but there's a lot of ads in there, but that's who we got our last ones from, is Bob Buchholz over in El Dorado. And he raises them and uses them. That's where I like to go from somebody that's using them, not just field trials and stuff like that. But Bud's deal on the dogs was he trained them just like he did the cattle. He wanted them to where if he had to go off and do something, then they were still, you know, driving the animals, and where he didn't, you know, wait a minute and come by. He didn't want to give them any commands other than what you and I would be saying, like go up there or go over there or lay down or whatever. Because, you know, some of them would be on the hill and some of them would be down in the draw. And once they got accustomed to talking just like you and I would, you know, they would do, you know. And we had some, there one time we had some cows killing the ewes back there on the ranch. And we had them, and where they were was in a little over a section of pasture. And we'd go out there on foot with two dogs and we'd pin them every night. And, you know, you think, well, how are you going to do that on foot? But it didn't take very long because, you know, they knew. You know, we were creek feeding the lambs in there, and we throw a little alfalfa out for the ewes. And after about four or five times of, you know, getting the movement going, you know, when they saw us and the dogs, everybody was going in. And, you know, it's, you know, you're not really trying to bait them, but you're trying to get them to where they don't hide from you like they used to, or be spoiled and get back and take their calves with them. But, you know, it was real unique to have him there that long because, you know, you always start something, and anyway, you got a question you want to ask him. He's not there to answer it. Yes. No. Because, you know, this place that these particular cows are on, we've only had it for a couple of years, and it's you know, we got, you know, maybe one or two. And we really need to do some development, but we're waiting to get a longer-term deal on it because, you know, we'll go in and do a lot of the improvements because we know what the benefits of them are going to be, but we want to make sure we're going to have it. A lot of that country out there is selling for, we run the big ranch we had leased for 80 years, sold to some guys from North Carolina that just bird hunt on it. And we developed it for them. You know, there's no livestock on it or anything. That's just what they're interested in. But you know, we don't, you know, I'd rather not. I mean, we try to move the cattle enough to get them to do that. You know, they move when we're moving them. Now, you know, you could do that if you've got a 50,000-acre pasture and trying to get them on the west side together. I mean, I wouldn't be opposed to that. I'm just saying, you know, those pastures aren't really that big to where we'd have to do that. Yes, sir. Right. No, I mean, his, you know, from what Bud was saying, you know, we try to stick our arms out. We're trying to make ourselves bigger. You know, and if you're using it to go in there and back a steer out and take a heifer off or something like that, you know, he probably wouldn't do it. I don't see a problem with that. But, you know, Bud, if you know Bud, he has a particular way the way he does things, and that's the way he does them. But, we did, you know, everybody was wore out when we got through working because they would scream and holler and quacked and poked. And, but when you're using them for that regard, I mean, you're not hurting the cattle. But, what, you know, we were poking and doing all the other stuff as well, and that was his main deal on it, was to, you know, not to use that because you ought to position yourself to where, you know, you can get those animals out of there. But I don't, you know, with doing like that, I don't think you're going to have a problem at all. Yes, sir. We put it out. We have it out before they get there, and when we let them into the pen, you know, of course, we got to get them all in there first. So there's some in there that are circling before we get to them, and then we've got some of them will go right to it. You know, but most of the time, when you put them in there, the ones start moving. They pull everything else around, and they just start milling and moving, and you know, basically, start, especially if they're balling, if you just weaned them. You know, yearlings coming in, they're a lot easier to do because they're not stressed from the wean; they're just stressed from the moving. But we had the feed and water out, and just once we kind of get them slowed down to where they're responding to where we're at, you know, when you're out to the side all the time, then we'll just basically try to move those cattle, you know, slow them down enough to where, you know, they'll have some eat and drink. And every time you go, you know, like when those cattle were laying down, and you go back out there an hour and a half later, you got some laying down, you get those cattle up, you know, there'll be that many more go eat and drink every time. Just because they're laying there doesn't necessarily mean they're full. They're just, they're probably tired. So we go ahead and get those cattle up, and wait, you know, most time we go and say, oh, they're laying down, they're in good shape. But if they're not eating and drinking, they're just laying there because they don't feel good. And so we'll get them up, and they ought to stretch or, you know, whatever, and get up, and then we'll just start that movement again and try to move those cattle to feed and move them back to water and do that 4 or 5 times a day. And, you know, like I said, you'll think you're out there not doing anything. But just your presence there of calming those cattle down makes worlds of difference on how quick they go to eat and how quick they drink. And, you know, I had some guys saying, well, you need to take them off of water when they come in because they'll fill up with water and it'll flush the rumen and they won't have the microbes in the rumen. But I don't have any basis to say yay or nay. I just like to have the feeding water out there for the cattle. If they were thirsty, they'd drink. If they were hungry, they'd eat. And we just keep working with that until, you know, basically, then if we had a few that were getting knocked back or weren't getting to it, then we'd separate them off and put them in a separate place where they had their own stuff, you know, out there. But something good, you know, we use whatever we've got. But a lot of times, you know, if you have an alfalfa grass hay or a coastal hay or something like that that they're really accustomed to eating, it smells good, you know, they'll get on it pretty quick. We don't try to put our receiving, we mix them receiving ration there with our mixing truck. But we'll put that in there with the bunks, but we like to have the hay in there first and let them eat through that and start picking whatever feed we're mixing. Probably both. I mean, you know, from what we used to do, we worked them and turned them out. We thought they needed to be out. And now, you know, you don't think of it as going in there and bothering them. You're going in there to help them, and just, you know, when we've had cattle, we needed a 2 or 3 acre pen just to where we could walk in there without them bunching up in the corner. And some of them can be in a corral this size, and you can walk in there, and it doesn't bother them. It just depends on the cattle, but at least have enough room where you're away from them and they're not moving, and you know they're still not moving. They're just, you've got enough room for them to be comfortable. Anybody else? Steve?
Well, we'll briefly switch technology here a little bit, but I think there's some interest in this topic, it looks like. How many of you have been injured? I know somebody who's been injured working cattle. Okay. Well, okay, there's probably one of the reasons to have a session like this somewhere. I think it's a videotape out of Oklahoma State University that deals with this. If you're interested in contact Oklahoma State University, I think the statement in that videotape is 67% of the animal injuries in that particular state was with cattle and working them. So that's one of the reasons we need to, you know, maybe address this topic, and you all share ideas today. That's probably going to be one of the most beneficial things that happens today. The other thing is probably financial. According to a beef quality audit, I think it was like $20 million lost each year in the beef cattle business due to bruising. If animals get bruised, that inspector tells you to cut that piece of meat out. And that animal certainly could probably have the finest nutrition and the best management, and yet if we lay a tube before to that animal before they get on the truck, especially if it's on those wonderful steak areas, we probably lost some money. Hopefully it's time to talk. We're going to take a break here, but then we get started late. We want to get you all out of here on time. But you've heard of horse sense, and I think Dalton has kind of talked about some cow sense on why we need to work cattle. He kind of went over that animal behavior. I'm kind of going to go over that corral design, and Dalton kind of covered the animal handling techniques. Well, employee animal injuries, as I mentioned, can be significant. And how many of those injuries, I'll ask you again, I got three different questions. One, if it was at the fault of the animal, your fault, or the fault of the facilities that you were working in. When you were injured or know somebody was injured, was it the fault of the animal? How many? All right. Okay. Well, it being there could be. About the third time you get hurt by the same animal, it's time to bring in the shotgun. And then there's that issue about buckshot. Maybe that's where that issue came up in Denver. How many was it because of your fault? Okay. Finally, was it the fault of the facilities you were working in? Okay. And I have to be politically correct. I have some Ohio producers in here. It was not the fault when I was injured because of those facilities. It was one of you other people's states when I was working in it that I got hurt in. Well, inadequate facilities can certainly be a factor in animal employee and animal injuries. And really, sometimes it's just something could be scaring them. You certainly might think about walking through the facility and see if there's that cup from having the morning cup of coffee laying there in the alleyway. And just walk through the facility before you work the animals. Do as I say, not as I do. I might have to put that caveat. I'm kind of guilty of kind of rolling in, working cattle and rolling out. but maybe that flapping shirt. Did we get anybody marking that? Nobody took my baby shirt, did they? Or my daughter's going to have my head. Yeah, okay. Somebody was marking that as a design flaw back there on the orange corral, the flapping shirt. And Doc mentioned loud noises. Well, sometimes for me, working cattle is an emotional release, but I'm not sure it is for the cattle. Therefore, yeah, walk through those facilities and just see if you see some problems. I work with some corral facilities at one location that we've used some guardrail from roads as the side of as the fence, and we do have some exposed edges or sharp edges mentioned there, and we have to go back in there and file that down. Certainly, we can use some alternative products for corrals and maintain low cost, but look around and see if you see things like that that are going to cause some injury to you or to the animals. I think that was fairly well covered by Dalton on how they perceive the world, just shadows. We need to remember cattle, you know, view the world differently. If you're a good cattle handler, somebody may say to you, you think like a cow. You really shouldn't be insulted by that, especially if you know them. But a shadow to a cow may well be to them a 3-mile-deep crevasse, big old ditch. So we need to think about how we can remove those shadows. Light and dark. If there's shadows in the alley, you may well observe some barking. A bright spot. Maybe you've got a place that's under roof, and you've used some used tin to produce an overhead. Great. But if there's a little hole and the sunlight is shining through that hole into a particular part of the facility, you might look up and see, is that where they're balking? And maybe on a day that doesn't rain, maybe get another piece of tin and fill in that little piece of hole so they don't balk so much. Maybe loading cattle at night. How's this idea? You know, I'm interested in your thoughts. Hanging the a frosted light bulb, you know, on a hook up in the truck, maybe to help load. Sometimes I'm guilty at night of loading cattle in the dark, and I'm putting the flashlight down the ground, making sure I don't step in something when I really should be shining the flashlight up into the trailer so the animals can see and so they'll load more easily. And also maybe that not shining the flashlight in their face, and that goes with the sunlight too. How many of our squeeze chutes should be facing east and west? Or north and south? East and west. Anybody? North and south. Okay, there's more hands there for north and south. And there's probably a legitimate reason for that. Think of working cattle early in the morning. You probably don't want that thing facing into the east. And if you're working cattle all day, you don't want to be facing west. So they don't like that sort of thing shining in their face. Dark buildings, electric overhead lights can be useful. I know that maybe we don't always have electricity, maybe a battery, even a boat battery, that would probably run all day, keeping some power going. Another alternative with an old building to get some light is maybe some white translucent fiberglass on the side, and that's unobstructed light coming in that's going to add light to the facility. So solid sides. How many of you criticize these facilities for not having solid sides? Okay, my only defense is, can you imagine how heavy these things would be if I did that? Certainly, solid sides should be considered. And uniformity in color. Maybe the cattle aren't that great in color definition, but they can tell differences. And a dark color where there's all light color can cause some balking as well. Aluminum, or silver, or yellow, something light and bright is probably a preferred color versus dark brown or dark red. Areas to consider making solid side, areas that I like, anyway, that working alley where they're single file, the loading chute, is a lot like a working alley, the crowding pen, and for myself, now here's an opinion. If there's one thing I want solid-sided in a corral, it's the sweep gate for a crowding tub and or in a working alley. Am I right? Okay. Why am I right? Anybody? Yeah. In the worst case, they can go forward and run through fence and out in the pasture again. That's aggravating. Or they can run sideways. But what's the worst case scenario? Running back at me. And so a solid side for that. And more and more I think about you. My children are young and starting to help me around. Sometimes I may put them on the sweet gate. I don't want animals coming back at my children. Well, take advantage. I think here, I think it was fairly, there's some suggestions for the turn finally here on the squeeze chute, but the majority of you that put down markers preferred the curved chute, curved working alley, to take advantage of their natural desire to escape. The only thing about a curved chute, yeah, that's good, but don't make it too sharp. If it appears to be a dead end, well, they're going to balk in a curved chute. My rule of thumb is I like the animals to see about two animals, that, middle of that second one. They may only be able to see their back end. But if they can see that, probably a minimum of a 12-foot radius, most of this is in the handout, so they can look ahead. So don't make curved chutes great, but don't make it too sharp. Cattle sense of hearing. Just there that animals, actually, they hear really well. That's why we need to quit yelling, as Dalton mentioned. They can't focus on where that sound is coming from, and that's going to slow them down. So that's another reason to control the amount of noise we make. Well, working animals that, if I've got a cow that's got mastitis on the right front quarter, which side is she more likely to kick me? Right. So keep that in mind in pushing animals up. Or with cancer eye, an animal that's, say, got cancer eye on the right side, she might be more likely to turn on you just to see what's happening on that right side. So if you could move her up, standing on the back left, that's probably a good idea. Dalton's kind of covered that fairly well. Why do cattle get excited? Well, it can be genetics. They're agitated by others of previous corral experience. With regard to genetics, fess up. How many of you have relatives at your family reunion you think are crazy? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if you think it happens in humans, why not in cattle? And a lot of times, anytime animals are agitated, I blame it on genetics. It couldn't be on my animal handling skills, heaven knows. But admittedly, genetics can be a real problem in a set of cattle. With this electronic ID, one of the things I'm kind of curious about is dark cutters. And if we can trace it back to different cow families. I know we've worked with some cattle in Ohio, not yours, Glenn, at another place. The cattle were fine out in the feedlot. But we weighed them every 30 days. It was kind of like a futurity. You all bring the cattle in and we'd feed them out. One owner every year. Every 30 days, we work his cattle, and they were not heads. And every year, he'd get some dark cutters in his animals. So I think there was a genetic base there. Certainly, in South Texas, what's the comment?
Did you ever see him sell cattle in an auction in South Texas? You got to do that someday.
Is that an environment? Maybe they haven't seen animals very often. Humans very often. All right. Okay. Well, maybe a score on those might not work so well. Well, previous handling experience can have an impact. Maybe if you don't want to use a scoring sheet in South Texas, you can think about something like this in a cow-calf herd. You pick your scale. This is in the handout. Working some cattle through, just kind of score them. It could be a 1-3 or A and B. Just how they handle. Certainly, I wouldn't call an animal the first time through that they act spastic. It could be the cow behind them, it could be the cow in front of them, making them upset, or I'm having a bad day with that particular animal and I'm causing the problem. So you might think about another culling tool. The older and older I get, the more and more important disposition is to me because I can't jump as high as I used to out of corrals. Now, I think this was kind of covered by Dalton, all those different things about yelling and prods. The only thing I mentioned here, I like to mention their kicking patterns. Do cats kick like Mike Tyson? Probably harder. Yeah. Strength-wise, you think they hit harder than a Mike Tyson. The other thing, do you agree? I think they're roundhouse punchers. Right? Doesn't that foot come up like a kicker? You know, like a soccer or football championship last night? I have to put that in there once in a while. It comes back around. They're roundhouse punchers. Really, it's a backward roundhouse. But if you're up behind an animal, you've got a couple steps on a cow to back off before she gets you. Where's the worst place to be? Kind of up front or toward the ribs. The only thing I mentioned about that, not so much with corrals, but if you've got kids or grandkids showing steers or heifers in the show, and it's happened to me, I've dropped that brush or the curry comb on the side. We need to reinforce to that youth to kick that away before they pick it up. Very important with youth. I'm not sure that I don't come up on the side of an animal that often to do anything while ultrasounding, but, you know, just them standing out there, I don't normally go up on the side unless I'm going to have to, I'm going to call a veterinarian and do some bloat problems. I think cows are a little bit different, though, aren't they? They got a quick kick almost directly back. So a lot of times if I'm working calves, I like to be right up on them. If I've got to be in with them, it would be nice to have a facility where I don't have to do that. But every once in a while, I'll be honest, I have to jump down in with them and push them on. And I want to be kind of up on them so they get that full extension. I'm still going to get kicked, but at least I don't get the full extension blow. I think this is kind of common sense, so I really don't want to cover too much there, and I think Dalton covered that fairly well on flight and turn into fight. Curved working chutes. Certainly, you might think about that as the ideal for a working alley. This catwalk over here is maybe an extravagance on the outside. Typically, on work chutes, there's where the handle's going to be, and so you can easily walk from here to here to work, you know, work those animals and push them up. That's probably, they talk about the natural ability to escape. But I'll be honest, I like curved chutes because I don't have to walk as far. Like I said, that's probably an extravagance, but I probably can't put it in there on the outside. I'd prefer it on the inside, yeah. Well, that's just talking about the importance of what bruises has an impact. And you think about it, once again, this could have been a great animal, but there's that bruise, and they're going to cause us to cut that out. Well, the other thing about bruises is a lot of us are maybe working on concrete, but it's old. And we talk about regrooving, but how, okay, maybe we will, maybe we won't get it regrooved. Think about having a bucket of sand out there, or something of dirt in a bucket when we're working cattle, as they're saying that squeeze chute, or as just as they're coming out. At least for me, that's where they slip most of the time. It's not back in the working alley. They're wanting to get out of that squeeze chute. As soon as they come out of there, they come out and their back heels slip underneath them and they hit the ground. So maybe some sand on some of our older concrete might be considered. Well, some feedlot operators might be able to track this. I'm not sure. Well, with the new alliances, maybe we can track this too with cow-calf operations. But lung bruises where they might happen. Narrow gates. Dalton talked about pushing cattle, you know, through an area that's made for one, that you got two with calves, and they get pushed back. That may be better than them getting squeezed. Or getting gates that hit on the side of the animal. I was guilty of that when I was a younger man, of bringing that old gate around on a pin and Friday afternoon, and I got better things to do. She's a pretty girl. And I hit them right there on their, right in front of their hooks, and I bruise them. And I'm not young anymore, so I don't do that much. Protruding latches, horns, shoulder bruises, some rough handling, broken flipper gates, protruding latches. The one here that I'm curious about is cattle that hit the head gate real hard. Over here on corral design, there was one, but the straight one, the runway or the alleyway being straight, and then this squeeze chute being straight on. Have you ever caught a calf that's coming fast? What does everybody say? Yes, way to go. And that's probably good, you know, versus having to run that calf around. But as I understand it, are there some veterinarians in here? Okay, tell me if I'm wrong. As I was understanding, I went to a program where they dissected the animal. And they were talking about injection site lesions. And they showed us that there's these large lymph nodes right here on the shoulders. And the inference could have been, they didn't say it specifically, but think about those calves that hit a head chute really hard. They may well bruise or damage these lymph nodes. You can probably have the finest vaccine around, but if you've damaged these, it may not do much good. I'm wondering, research-wise, or maybe we should as producers, have padded on the inside of the squeeze chute on the front end. So there on this, say, self-catch on the inside, those calves that hit there, there's padding on the inside. I don't know of a manufacturer that does that, and I can't prove by research that, yeah, we'd reduce sickness and death loss if we had that. But you think about football players. You know, they hit those blocking sleds. Can you imagine if they weren't padded? Well, and if those lymph nodes are there, maybe we need to think about having some padding there. Just a theory, don't know. Comment? I don't know if they have lymph nodes there, but they get by all right. But for cattle, I'm curious if that would be of benefit, especially in feedlots. Back bruises and properly adjusted one-way gates, especially the vertical ones. You know, you got to back those backstop gates. What I'm doing is, you know, sometimes I hit them, and I don't mean to, but hitting on the top, we can get some bruising there. Okay. Well, some of the bruises just could be, we're working on our time, and maybe we need to work on cow time or calf time, just slowing down a little bit. Basic corral design, it's got to be accessible, proximity, adequate drainage, maybe availability of electricity. I think in Ohio, we've got a lot of folks, so being close to neighbors, and some of our neighbors aren't raising cattle, we've got to be sensitive to that. The basic sections of the corral. There's the holding pens, the alley for working the cattle where you're moving them up, the crowding pen or tub, the working alley where they're single file, restraining area, and a loading area. This is just an example. It's not meant to be the ideal. Just an example of some holding pens. There's several of them there, and then maybe there's some extra pens down here for sorting. This is maybe fancier than we need to be, but it's an example for just design. Some of the common flaws, maybe that you've worked in, the pens are too large. Do you work in pens sometimes that you got to have two people to bring the cattle out? That could be a case if you've got big, you know, large herds of cattle and you can't get away from that. Maybe the working alley is too narrow. Probably, I think you mentioned like that working alley being about 10 feet, 16 feet is probably wide enough. Because if cattle are getting by me, I'm one person in a working alley. Maybe the cattle are crazy, or that working alley is a little narrow. But at the same time, I want maybe the 10 feet. I don't want it 4. That's a little close for me for those cattle, especially if they want to get past me. Inadequate number of pens. Maybe we finally figured out we want to sort more than we planned on it, so having enough pens. And poor placement of gates. Back here on corral design. Yeah, we got marked some. There's a gate that comes, I'm going to say, from the pasture, and there's several yellow dots on it. There should be more. It's right in the middle, so those cattle can go to the left, they can go to the right, or they can go through. Would you prefer they just go where you want them to go? So you may need to think about having gates on corners, be it in the pens or bringing them in from a pasture area, not in the middle of a fence. Well, this is, an extravagant design that has gates on both sides of the pen. Maybe you can bring another fence down through there. Sometimes that might be the easiest thing to do. If you've got a big pen, just bring a fence down through the middle of it. And there you got two pens. You might have to put a gate on, but that relieves a lot of those problems. And the design, it's confusing. You might see this as somebody's got an old barn that they want to use for corral design. And, well, the way it's situated, maybe it's hard to put the pens right next to the squeeze chute, so it, you know, the cattle kind of work through. Well, that can slow cattle up, understanding maybe use the barn or try to design around that. You know, dairy barn, you know, it's got an excellent structure, still dry, but if the alleyway is a bit confusing, how to get there can be a bit of a challenge. Well, they can be 10 to 12 feet. Crowding tub, let's see, back here. And there'll be some people who don't agree with me that of these designs, I guess I like the one that's up on the board. Well, everybody kind of, they like, there's a couple folks here. And I've gotten some argument on this. You know, a crowd design is a art, not so much of a science. So you may have to decide. But I think everybody kind of showed that they like having just a slope to it. I know on interstate, I like to have gradual, if I'm going through construction, a gradual back down versus having it straight right here. Well, I call this a swirl area. You know, if they're going to turn, they'll probably do it here. If that's an abrupt change, there's a swirl area, and those animals are going to want to turn, and that can be an aggravation. A curved tub is excellent. This is just an example of a straight side, but has one side at an angle. The example over here, this is where you have a crowding tub going into a working alley. In other words, you've got animals that are in a 10 to 14 wide area, and you want to crowd them down to single file. And maybe you've got a roof overhead. Great. Probably the worst place, though, to actually have that crowding tub go down to single file is right on the edge. Right there, you've got to change from light, if this is outside, going under the roof into dark. There's a change in texture. Those animals are going to see that. So they're more likely to bolt right there. So it's probably better, if you're going to do that, have that crowding area a little bit further out, say 10 to 15 feet or something like that, where they go single file before they go under the roof. Okay? And that was over here, one of the design options. So having a roof's great, but that's probably, you want to have that, extend this out a little bit further, or of course, if you've got a big enough roof, you can put all that stuff under roof. Say that the crowding tub's under roof, great. How many cattle to move up? My rule of thumb is about half of what I can hold in the crowding tub. I'm guilty of it. How many of you filled a crowding tub? You liars. The kicker is when I do that, and if I get one or two turned up front, I've got to back that off, and you know I've got to take some pressure off so they can end up turning and have enough room to move. So about half the tub. Even if that room, you could be guilty like me going to 3/4 or 7/8. So start at a half. Well, a sweet gate, admittedly, if there's anything I like solid, there's a lot of things I like solid, but where I start is that sweet gate. And the see-through, those small gates you might have in your working alley where they're single file, probably they should be able to see through. That way, when that gate, say, comes up or goes off to the side, or if certainly it's a T hanging down, they can see the animal head moving. Working chute, well, we talked about the curve, and as I mentioned, yeah, I'll reiterate, I was designing this when I thought I had lots of money. I probably don't need a catwalk on the outside. It's probably just going to be here on the inside. But you can make simple working alleys on a lot of operations that apply that same basic design. Even here, you know, the sweep gate, this is not a curved area. You can make it that way. But even if it isn't that sweep gate, a person could stand over here and kind of follow those animals around. Working alley, you might consider slope sides in that working alley. Maybe some of you have that. I see a lot of manufacturing equipment. homemade stuff I see is straight-sided. Backstops, how many of you like a tee backstop or some sort of hanging down in the working alley? Okay. Anybody don't like them? Yeah. In a transition spot. You might check in a facility if that's where it's at. In a turn or a darkness, do you mean that? Yeah. Okay. Admittedly, I lean to not liking them a whole lot, but they're great if they're put in right and they're not noisy. Yeah. And maybe you've got them adjusted correctly. They're falling about 6 inches below the tail head, or what height do you like them hanging down below the calf, 6 inches below the tail head? That's pretty good. All right. Well, once again, we're getting into art, not science. Huh? I'm an expert in Tennessee, but... Okay. But those are some of the things, at least an aggravation sometimes with me with some of the backstops, is they can have some problems. Transition, they're not properly adjusted, they hang down too far, or they're noisy. If there's a place I like to have a backstop, once we get my opinion, is probably 10 or 15 feet behind the squeeze chute. You know, if I can get a couple head moved up, and then when that squeeze chute comes loose, I can bring that next animal come up. I don't like to have one really close where you've got the single file. I want them to get in single file from the crowding tub. I don't like to have one there too close. Squeeze chute, make sure it's a good working order. Adjust to fit the cattle before they walk through. Like I say, do as I say, not as I do. I get into trouble with working bulls and cows at the same time. Squeeze chutes. There's a lot of Midwest plan services. I'm going to recommend them as a source of information. But they have these, how you build your own squeeze chute. And maybe some of you have those abilities. I don't. If I'm going to get a squeeze chute, I'll probably buy it. And that's easier for me. Well, and this is not unique to Ohio Beef Quality Assurance. It's national. Is the new recommendation for giving injections higher in the neck, the intramuscular injections. And I'm not going to get big into that, but there's been some detection of like a green tin, let's say a flat iron steak. I'm not sure that green tins doesn't hurt anything, but the consumer might be concerned about it. Well, to put those further up there, we need to maybe look at our squeeze chutes. New designs are coming out, not necessarily stretching the head, but there's more space between where the actual, you know, I'm going to call it the squeeze, and where this head chute. Like in this design, there's no room right in there for me to slip my hand through to put in an injection. The new ones are put in a space there, so we can more easily access that higher part of the neck. Lean chutes, those are some general recommendations on width. Curve can work here in loading cattle, just like it does in that single file working alley. The unloading can actually be wider. What do you want, cattle come off the truck? No. The comment was, what about the neck extenders? I find they take away that higher part of that neck for me. Maybe let the animal step back a little bit might be a way to still get that access to that part of the neck. But yeah, if you just move too far forward and you don't have a neck extender, that reduces that area where you can give a shot. The cattle, you've already kind of tightened them down so they can't. Well, I'm stumped. Anybody got a suggestion? Okay. The catheter idea is that, you know, the water is squeezed down, but maybe put a, I'm going to use the term backstop. Is that what you mean? Yeah. Kind of something in here to, you know, keep the animal pulled up in there. Necessarily have to be single file. I probably should have commented, this is probably an unloading chute. That's maybe a little wide most of the time for loading cattle. It's probably best when you're loading cattle to have them single file and let them come off at a in a wider group. That's just pulling straight forward so you don't have to back up. A self-aligning bumper, that would probably solve a lot of it. My problems, I'm not very good at backing anymore, and especially a big truck, I probably would wring my hands. But a self-aligning bumper for a large truck when we're backing up, so even if we're not plumb with that thing. Wing gates, so that even if we're not plumb, we bring those in, and we can still get the cattle off. And general recommendations, I think you can find most of this in most any publication, talking about using a ramp. Some information, the first ones are OSU beef team, but, you know, several universities have excellent sites for information. The two that probably I think you might look at if you want some more information, the second one is Midwest Plan Services, that MWPS, headquarters.org. There's a couple really nice publications there, one from Oklahoma State University that I like very well, and one from Alberta. On corral designs that I like very well, and I think they're like $7 or $9 a piece. You might find some other things there. Midwest Plan Services is more for facilities. They don't talk about genetics or nutrition or health there, but they talk about facilities and facilities design. We have the handout that you have. We have up on the web, but once again, I think and then Temple Grandin. I think she's probably one of the certainly recognized people in the world in animal behavior and design, and she has a website as well. And we're about 3 minutes over three, I think. And when do we have to wrap this thing up? Right now, we are being told to wrap it up. So, you're not going to get to be broken up into teams and design corrals. I apologize for that, but thank you for coming, and I know Dalton and I appreciated your attendance.